Everybody, and welcome to A Penny for Your Thoughts. I'm Jim Turpin, and as promised, we have a room full of people here today. This is our three amigos meeting once again, Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman, Circuit Judge Michael McCuskey, and the News Gazette's opinions editor Jim Dye. We've had this show several times. We've had a lot of fun and a lot of good information, and like to answer your questions. Here's how you get on: 356-9397. And the Castle Heating and Cooling text line is 351-5357. So if you have a question or a comment that you would like to ask any of our panel members, jump right in. And no question is... Some people say, oh, I don't want to ask that. That's a silly question. And, well, maybe, but we've had answered a lot of silly questions before and given a lot of silly answers. So, gentlemen, welcome. How are you, Brother McCuskey? Having a nice drive down this morning from the north. What's the name of that place?
Marshall County, Lakin, Illinois, 100 12 miles from this location.
And how was the drive? No snow?
It's a beautiful day driving. You know, no bugs on your windows this time of year.
Justice Steigman, how are you this morning?
Terrific. Always great to be here with you guys. And I commend Mike for making this drive. Makes me feel like I have no complaint to just have to get up early for the program when he's driving all that distance.
And Jim Dye, of course, has a difficult time making it here. He's... what, about 100 feet away, but he's always the last one here.
You know, if you're a diva, you got to show up late.
A diva. Let's. We've always start out with something just kind of fun and not very lawyer-related, or law-related, either one. So let's just talk about a little bit about the football and basketball and the Cubs and the Cardinals and things like that. What about the rules that they're trying to come up with to make baseball a little faster? Get those 3 and 4 hour games down a little bit, and some of them even win 5 hours. What do you think, Michael?
Well, did they pass the rule that the catcher counts the same as the manager? So if the manager comes out once to talk to the pitcher, and the catcher then in the same inning comes out to talk to the pitcher, that's two. The pitcher's gone. That would make a big difference, because if you watch, the catchers are coming out all the time now. That's one. They're trying to get the batter in the box, make the pitcher throw the ball. I was as a White Sox fan, Mark Burley used to throw the ball about every 5 seconds, and you could get from Mark Burley, Bob Gibson, Fergie Jenkins, a two-hour-plus game. But the real cheat, if you watch, is how long you can go get something in the refrigerator between innings and the bathroom, because I think the commercials are now 3 minutes a half inning. That's 6 times 9. That's what they do in the playoffs. That's an hour right there.
You have any idea about that, Bob?
Well, I agree with Mike. I have been a long-time baseball fan, and the games are just longer now because it's not just a matter of the commercials. I think, I was a big White Sox fan, but Paul Konerko used to drive me crazy because after every pitch, you'd have to step out of the box.
It's a Velcro problem.
No, they Velcro. Yes. You got to adjust the gloves and adjust everything. And, you know, it drives me crazy. And it's not that hard. As Mike says, just say you're in the box. You have to ask permission to step out, and it's not going to be granted easily or for a long time. But just say the ball's back to the pitcher. He's going to throw it in, what, 10 seconds, Mike?
Shit. I you know, 20 seconds used to be a rule, but
you know, just throw the ball because it's really affecting the game. It's just taking too long, and there's too much of this dancing around.
The other thing is there only one guy in New York watching 15 different games? Sometimes the people in the stands know within 30 seconds the guy was safe at second base. It wasn't close, and 5 minutes later you get the same call from New York.
Jim Dye, you and I were talking about basketball and the basketball scandal, if it turns out to be that. All these guys, assistant coaches, are getting arrested, and Bruce Pearl is kind of in the headlines.
I think our buddy Bruce
now
is in trouble.
Is that what you think?
That's what I understand. I mean, you know, they charged one of his principal assistants, Chuck Person, I think. He was actually indicted. I understand that Auburn is conducting an internal investigation, that Bruce Pearl isn't cooperating. So the name Bruce Pearl probably doesn't mean a lot to people who haven't been following Illinois basketball. But for those of us who've been around since the mid-'80s and watched what happened with the NCAA investigation involving Bruce Pearl and Deion Thomas, that's a name that's seared in our brain. And I'm sure there will be a lot of Illini fans who are really going to be take some, was it Schadenfreude? Is that the word, Judge Steigman?
Yeah, you got it, Schadenfreude.
If they see Bruce Pearl go down for a second time for misconduct, the NCAA's star witness, this is going to be the second time. So,
on the subject of sports, it's one other thing I wanted to mention, Jim, is there's a story from the Tribune 2 weeks ago about how the Pennsylvania governor signed legislation to legalize online sports betting in that state. And it goes back to one of my pet bugaboos that I'm forced to go out to Las Vegas to make sports bets. They expect to rake in $200 million annually from taxes and casinos, license fees. And, you know, it's a voluntary tax. It's like the people who are silly enough to buy lotto tickets or whatever. Well, you know, as Jim Thompson said, it's entertainment. No one can expect to win, but you put down a dollar and you can have all these fantasies. In fact, it would be a lot better bet to be able to bet on sports teams. It would be voluntary taxation on a guy like me. I'd put down my $25 bet and the state can take its chunk of it and the people who provide the facilities can get happy. And I don't understand why it is, given our terrible financial situation, that the state doesn't even consider it. Is it the church lady factor again? They're trying to save my soul, keep me from demon gambling. Of course, I keep saying it's too late, ladies, leave me alone, but it doesn't seem to work.
Jim, you wanted to talk to the our two judges here about, speculate a little bit about the validity of these legal charges?
Yeah, I've read some legal commentary on the federal charges in the basketball case, and there's been some suggestions that maybe the feds are overreaching in some capacities. And I just wonder what, Mike, you as a federal judge, I mean, the federal government can do pretty much what it wants, but do you have any thoughts at all about, as a former federal judge, about the criminal charges filed in the basketball case?
Are you talking about Patino or Pearl or
no? We're talking about the guys that have
North
been charged.
Carolina going to class.
No.
This
talking about, you know what I'm talking about.
I do, but you know the interesting thing that people don't know. They assume that the Attorney General of the United States runs 94 districts. Wrong. I've watched Republicans. I've watched Democrats. I've watched three districts in Illinois. I've been on committees for all the time I was on the federal court from judges all over, and you get to talking around a drink and you find out the 94 districts, the U.S. attorney in that district does what he wants, and usually the assistants do what they want. So there's no unified federal dumb down, do this. They can write those memos, but those people are like the United States senators. The attorney general comes and goes. We stay for decades.
Let's take
so
some,
I don't know who's doing it, but I can tell you it's not coming from Washington, D.C.
Okay, let's take some calls here. J.R. is first. Hello, J.R.
How you guys doing this morning?
We're doing great. What's on your mind, buddy?
Do you think Illinois is going to legalize marijuana anytime soon? They could use the money.
Marijuana in Illinois is de facto legal right now because it's been decriminalized, and I think small possession for small amounts is what a fine-only offense, and I don't even think there's much enthusiasm for that. As far as whether or not marijuana will be legalized, people in Illinois look at Washington and Colorado and say that's some kind of a revenue panacea, and so I think virtually all the Democratic candidates, except Chris Kennedy, who's been notably reluctant to endorse it, are on board with the legalization of marijuana. I think that's probably coming at some point in the future, and maybe not in the too distant future. What do you think, Bob?
I agree, I think it's probably well overdue. It's, again, throwback to people who just don't like what you want to do with yourself, and they're going to prohibit you from doing it because it's just bad. Well, enough of that.
Let me throw in one thing that's interesting, because I did, now I'm sitting in Peoria again, but sitting in the rural counties, I watched a dramatic difference from when I grew up to now. Used to be cold beer meant get one for the road, a road soda. And lots of people in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s in the rural area drank a beer and drove. Not intoxicated, just I'm driving a beer from my house to grandma's house, one beer. You can now smoke one joint from your house to grandma's house and pay $120. But if you have a can of beer open, you are in trouble for that open container of beer that's going to go against your insurance, etc. So we have a dramatic difference between one toke and one beer right now, and the legislature hasn't done anything to try to say, are we encouraging people to smoke a joint instead of a can of beer? People do it in the rural area. They always have. They still do.
Let's see what Alan has to say. Hello, Alan.
Good morning. I was wondering if anybody had any ideas on how to keep from getting unwanted phone calls. I get multiple calls every week about my credit cards, my computer network. I'm on the no-call list. I've even tried, you can punch a certain sequence on your phone and return the phone call. And all that did was get me charged $3.
Alan, let me jump in on this. You think you work for the federal government, you're a federal judge, and you can walk down and talk to the U.S. attorney and get something done. My wife complains about this all the time. You go to the U.S. attorney and he says, Mike, I have the same problem. These all come from countries that don't have treaties with the United States. That's where the calls originate from. That's where the phishing, trying to get you to answer something, comes from. There's no way the federal government can stop it. The no-call list is for people in the United States. So we are now part of a world that's flat, and people can use the phone anywhere in the world, and they can also use the computer anywhere in the world, and we're stuck.
You know, that's actually a good way to increase employment. Let's repeal our no-call rule. And let some Americans
bring jobs back home.
Bring jobs back home. See, you can't win when you deal with these people. You're dealing with smart people. They know how to get around the rules.
And you're getting them on your cell phones now, too. For a long time, cell phones were sort of someplace that you felt safe, and you got them only on the landlines. Now the landlines are disappearing, and somehow they're getting them on the cell phones.
You know, I hate to...
Anything else, Alan?
No, that was it. I mean, I tried playing along with these guys and say, oh, I got $1 million on my credit card, or I'll say I got $5,000. And I can never actually find out, you know, what they're trying to get out of me.
You know, what you might think about doing is going to cost you some money, is maybe a caller ID might help. But other than that, I think you're stuck, just like all of us.
Okay, very good.
Jim, what they're doing, because my wife shows me and I start getting them on the cell phone, they give you numbers that are similar to your area. Area code, and even in Lakin, Illinois, she got two the other day that started with 246, 309-246. There aren't that many 246s, but they somehow can computerize all this stuff.
We need to take a break here. We're have some callers waiting. We're at 356-9397. Text us at 351-5357 back after this. We're back with Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman with Circuit Judge Michael McCuskey and Jim Dye from the News Gazette. And Jim is next. Hello, Jim.
Yes. Can you hear me?
We hear you fine. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Hey, guys, Jim, I'm sorry to hear that you're leaving, and I want to tell you that you had a wonderful show, and I very seldom miss it, and I call in quite a bit, too. And I wish you good luck in your endeavors. But what I just tuned in just a little bit ago, but I was watching Face the Nation, and I watch them programs. I tape them, and on Sunday, and I was appalled to hear. Maybe you guys have heard about it. I want to get your perspective on this. If a girl has been harassed, or a victim have been harassed out on Capitol Hill, a victim must wait 3 months to file a complaint, then first submit to 30 days of counseling, wait another 30 days for mediation, and then another 30 days to seek a hearing. Then if there's a settlement, it is paid by the taxpayers and not the perp. So over $15 million has been paid out to the victims, and nobody has ever been exposed. And I've called my congressman and my senators, and I can't get much of an answer. They said, well, you know, this is just unfolding, but now, if they paid out $15 million, it ain't... You know, just Al Franken, you know. So there's a bunch of them. Did you guys ever hear of anything like this before?
Well, let me take the first shot. No, I haven't, and I can't believe that now that we know where to look, maybe Mike McCuskey can correct me if I'm wrong, I can't believe that Congress can expend money without having it be revealed, without having someone be able to find out who did you spend money to? Who did you spend money? Who was given it, and for what reason? What about that, Mike?
Well, my first thing is somebody may have been in court and got a settlement for $15 million. I have had $15 million cases this year. But the procedure you talked about getting there, I think, is fake news.
You don't think it's true?
I don't. Not the procedure. 30 days counseling. I don't believe that.
What does the
well, if it is true, let's just say if it is true, I would say it's a perfect example of what happens when people are writing the rules by which they will be held accountable. And so, what do? It's a sham. It's the same thing with the legislative inspector general in Illinois, which we've just gone through this business in Springfield, where the post was vacant for 3 years and the legislative leaders were happy to leave it vacant, and all of a sudden this woman comes forth and says, Senator Silverstein harassed me, and I tried to file it with the inspector general, but there's no inspector general, and everybody in the legislature said, what, there's no inspector general? I'm shocked.
Well, Tom Homer, the previous inspector general who quit because the job was so toothless and he wasn't given any authority, the background on him is he was a Democratic state legislator who became a state appellate judge. And I knew him well, and he's a really sharp guy. And it's the old story of, we made a mistake. We put somebody in here who's sharp and wants to do the job. Time to undercut him.
Right, and
also,
he's a former prosecutor.
Yes.
What does the law say about sexual harassment? What is it?
I could now spend a week on a seminar on this, Jim.
Just try to do it a little quicker than that. But
it's a lawsuit.
He'd like to spend a week. That way he could talk for a week.
No, it's a lawsuit. I could also tell you stories about cases I had, even involving university presidents.
Well, I was going to ask you that next.
But it isn't an easy thing to
say.
The law goes on, Jim, like the IRS code.
Okay.
It isn't.
Well, it's essentially you can't treat people badly on account of sex.
Oh, okay.
If you treat everyone badly, that's a defense. I mean, really, it's not a matter of touching, but if you're treating someone badly, male and female, as far as your discussions, your demeaning of them, and all that, that's not actionable. But if you're singling out women for instance, and it can be on account of sex, then that can be an actionable claim. It's written in kind of broad terms and fleshed out by the cases.
The facts mean everything.
Have either of you had many back when you were a circuit judge?
Well, I see it in the appellate court. Yeah. We have some of these cases, and, you know, it's not tricky by the time it gets up there. You know, it's the old story of Potter Stewart's wonderful line, and may not know how to define it, but I know it when I see it. The kinds of cases we've seen, if the trier fact believed the complainant, this is not a tricky case. It's like Charlie Rose, by the way, who's the epitome of smugness, as someone who's had occasion to watch this guy for years and before I could turn off the channel. He's the kind of stuff he did and that Weinstein did. You know, you don't have to be checking in the statute book, say, gee, is this covered? You bet.
Well, I think it could almost be covered as a criminal conduct in some cases, not just civil harassment.
Glenn Beck, who's on radio in Peoria, used to be on Fox and CNN and other channels, but he's on radio now, and he said something interesting yesterday. He said, watch the politics. If it's a Democrat that's accused of doing sexual harassment, the Republicans attack him, the Democrats find an excuse. If it's vice versa, he said the hypocrisy of politics now. Our guy never did anything wrong, your guy did, and it's back and forth.
It'd be a more persuasive argument if 95% of these guys weren't Democrats and liberals.
I think you're wrong, Bob. Let's just stop playing politics. That's what Glenn Beck said. Everybody wants to play politics, and nobody wants to work on the problem.
Well, you can, first of all, identify it for what it is. 95% of them are leftists and Democrats. The only one who isn't,
Bob,
at the moment is Roy Moore.
Come on. Did you ever listen to Glenn Beck?
No.
Well, he's to the right of Rush Limbaugh.
Therefore what? That makes him believable?
I can't educate you. You're too political.
Okay.
Well, the problem is not the behavior. It's the power that the individual holds. So the Democrats don't want to lose Al Franken in the Senate because the Senate's closely divided and they lose his vote. The Republicans have the problem that Roy Moore is the same thing on the other side. If Roy Moore loses in Alabama, then the Democrats are only down 51-49 instead of 52-48. So it's not that they're going to excuse this guy. It's that we need his power, so we have to live with it.
We need to break for the news headlines here. We have several callers waiting. Got a good discussion going. We'll continue, but Brian Barnard has the news headlines, and we'll be back and continue right after that. Here is Brian. We're back on A Penny for Thoughts. My guests today are Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman, Circuit Judge Michael McCuskey, and Jim Dye from the News Gazette. We've had several people waiting. Let's see what they have to say this morning. We go to Dave. Hello, Dave.
Hey, good morning. I was wondering, are judges required to participate in the judges' retirement system, or is there a mechanism, an option for them to
participate in what?
Elect not to retirement. Participate in the judges. Judge your retirement system, hence paying the Social Security.
Well, in Illinois, you are become a member unless you affirmatively choose not to, like within the first month of being elected. At least that's the way it was when I was first elected. And once that happens, then you're in the system, and you can't get out if you want to change your mind.
So, Judge Steigman could tell you a little bit about that if you'd like to hear more.
Okay. It's a wonderful system. It's actually the best retirement system in the world. The only trouble is you have to retire to take advantage of it. So I'm at loggerheads on that.
I once had the pleasure of watching Judge Steigman report in some litigation that he filed asking to be released from participation in the judicial retirement system. And it was amazing to watch the judge rule against the judge.
I lost.
He lost. You know what they say about it? A guy who represents himself, you know.
There you go.
A lawyer who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But anyway, I thought you made a brilliant argument, and that judge wasn't smart enough to accept it.
Well,
Dave, you have to jump in here if you have a follow-up.
Yeah, I was wondering, so has either Judge McKaysey or Steigman, are you eligible for Medicare?
Everybody's eligible for Medicare at age 65. I signed up. I don't know if Bob did.
Well, how was your Medicare eligibility determined if judges don't participate in Social Security?
I did participate in Social Security for more than 40 quarters before I ever became a judge. See, I'd like to be a judge at 18, but I started working. Once you get 40 quarters, you're in Social Security. Some of the judges complain that we don't get much benefit from Social Security other than eligibility for Medicare. However, Bob and I keep working. We pay. I pay a huge Medicare premium that I've never once had a Medicare claim.
Yeah, in my case, I have health insurance through the state health policy, and whatever the policy is what I get. I've never signed up for anything special, as far as I know.
Did you sign up for Medicare?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Bob. Hello, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call this morning. My three topics this morning are going to concern the Constitution and what the Founding Fathers were thinking when they did gerrymandering, the Electoral College, and gun access. And so I'll let you touch those topics.
I don't think they actually did anything about gerrymandering.
No.
They specifically, the subject of gerrymandering, guns, I think it's pretty clear, the Second Amendment. And what was the third thing you mentioned?
The Electoral College.
Oh, the Electoral College.
No, the Electoral College is, I think, a clear example of how we are a federal system, and it's to give protection and importance to the states so that you have to carry states to be elected president, so that even though, as Hillary likes to point out, I won the popular vote, well, you got all these votes in California and New York, which put you over the top of the popular vote, but that doesn't matter. For the same reason, by the way, that the Founding Fathers had the wisdom in the famous Connecticut Compromise to come up with a bicameral legislature, so we have representation by population in the House of Representatives, which accounts for why I think California is like 52 or something like that representatives in Congress. Yet in the Senate, we have two senators per state, notwithstanding population. So Alaska and Wyoming, I think, are the two smallest states in population. They each have two senators, as does California. And I think it was a brilliant compromise because our states are important and our federal system is important. And that's one of the ongoing battles, as a matter of fact. There's a lot of people in Congress, regrettably from both parties, ignorant Republicans, as I like to deem them, who don't have enough respect for the federalist system and who believe, as do so many Democrats, that if there's anything the federal government should do, it can do it, and it's empowered to do it, and that's just not the way things should work.
On gerrymandering, it's really interesting because it comes about, it's been done for over 100 years, but it comes about when you have the House and the in our General Assembly, the House and Senate of one party, the governor of one party, and then I'll tell you about, everybody assumes this can be done every 10 years, that when the census comes out and then redistrict the state politically. I think it's 30-some states now have absolute good gerrymandering. They've run the table. Illinois is one of 8 Democrat states, and there's over 25 or 6 Republican states, which is why I believe the House of Representatives is going to stay Republican for a long time. So there's nothing illegal about gerrymandering. Both parties do it, have done it. But Tom DeLay pulled something in Texas that most people have not followed through. They changed it before 10 years, didn't want to wait, when they finally had all of the right party, the Republicans, and the Supreme Court said you don't have to wait 10 years.
One quick point on gerrymandering, by the way. There's a case now pending before the U.S. Supreme Court on gerrymandering, which is the essence, as far as I'm concerned, of judicial activism. We had, despite it's been 200 years of gerrymandering, and despite prior decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court saying this is a matter that's left to the legislative bodies, we now have an argument being made that, oh, it's just not good policy. And if it's not good policy, then by God, it must be against the Constitution. And the U.S. Supreme Court has this case now pending, and I think it would be awful if the U.S. Supreme Court somehow were to come down and say, no, this is it's a violation of constitutional rights to politically discriminate on the basis of party as you district your new congressional and House and Senate districts in the House, state House. And it's crazy. It's awful. The Seventh Circuit bought this argument to its discredit, and hopefully the U.S. Supreme Court will reject it.
One minor correction on that. The Seventh Circuit didn't buy it. There was a special three-judge panel in Wisconsin that heard it initially, and it's being appealed directly to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Bob is absolutely right. The Wisconsin case has the real potential to kind of turn the system upside down. So we'll have to see where that goes. It's going to be 5-4. With respect to
And that's Republican redistricting, gerrymandering in Wisconsin,
yes,
right?
Yes, right. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, and we were talking initially about how the founders decided what they're going to do with gerrymandering. We're talking the whole point behind the Constitution is we don't want anybody pushing anybody else around. We don't want the majority picking on the minority, which they call the tyranny of the majority. We don't want the minority. We want majority rule. So you create this balance of power. The balance of power, say, with two members of the Senate and House being based on population, and the whole idea is we don't want to make great changes unless there's really consensus to do it. And the best way to do so is to allow the minority substantial to say about what's going on, and that's kind of what the Constitution is all about. With three separate branches of government, where everybody's watching theoretically each other like a hawk, and they're very defensive about any kind of intrusion. So, I think it's a brilliant system, and I'm amazed that we had people around at that time that were that smart.
Now we do have to remember the Constitution was white male, women didn't vote, and blacks were not part of the system.
Well,
some of us would say that's a perfect system. Four white males in the room, we
ought
to decide.
You're way off, Mike, on that, because I think it's unfair to judge people that lived 200 or 300 years ago by the standards of today. I mean, is there any other country in the world? Is there any other country in the world with these evil white males?
I didn't say that. You did.
No, come on. You're saying.
No, I'm being factual. Women didn't vote.
That's right.
The citizens didn't select their senators. That was done by the legislature.
Might not have been a bad idea.
And I think, blacks were half for the Electoral College
or something? Once again, we have a compromise because slavery goes back to before this country even existed.
And I'm just saying, I'm a former history teacher. Just teach the history the way it was. The point is factual. I'm trying to... When people say, what did the Founding Fathers intend, we also have to say... Things have changed.
Well, of course things have changed. And you know why they've changed? Because the founders created a document that was capable of dealing with societal change. And I think, once again, you know, even though they were evil white males, that's not necessarily...
No, you're playing politics. Now, on the gun, that was guns. His third was guns.
Yeah.
And it took us how many years for the Supreme Court to say what it really meant? That you have the right to bear weapons.
Now, what does that have to do with the white males?
I'm trying to say, historically, not all these things were very clear, even to the Supreme Court.
Well, I could
Court.
Point out that the first majority of the founders were from Virginia. And you'd say, what's the point? And I'd say, there is no point.
You're attacking me because I'm being historically correct.
You're bringing up facts, and then you say, what's the point of that fact? And you say, oh, nothing.
What was his first point? What did the Founding Fathers mean? It took us 200 years for the Supreme Court to say what the Second Amendment said.
Well, now, we all know that the Constitution means whatever a judge says it means. So there
or
were just,
the newspapers.
We don't have that kind of clout. So when you have the Supreme Court saying it doesn't mean the right to bear arms, you could have said, well, that's what it took 150 years for the Supreme Court to say it doesn't mean you have the right to bear arms. I mean, courts change interpretations.
Plessy versus Ferguson took a long time before Brown. We have to be factually correct. It takes time to interpret some of this stuff.
Okay, guys, let's see what Tony has to say about this. Hi, Tony.
Tony, you want to step into this argument, Tony, and separate the pugilists here?
Well, I want to go back to what the one judge was saying about the Democrats being the sexual harassers. he's just factually wrong. I mean, most of the Republicans that have been caught are paying these women absurd amount of money. Like Bill O'Reilly, what kind of sexual harassment do you have to do for $32 million settlement. I don't know how much Bill O'Reilly's worth, but I can't imagine him being worth more than $100 million. So you're going to give a woman a third of your income?
I think he must have had a bad lawyer. Yeah, Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly is a, I think we're talking about public officials, not necessarily commentators, although Bill O'Reilly is certainly identified with the conservative movement. But, you know, this thing is really not partisan at all, I don't think. I mean, I think you've got guys, Democrats and Republicans, who are older guys who are interested in younger women, and that kind of, I think, is a bipartisan interest.
Well, I don't think it's older guys and younger guys. I think it's men in general. I mean, men are dogs.
Well, I know, but the girls don't object so much when the guy's not 70 years old. they object less when he's 25 and he doesn't have any authority over him.
Well, that's true, and that's my next point. So Charlie Rose is an older man who gets fired one day after these things come out.
He's suspended. He's not fired, but go ahead.
Well, but then Ryan Seacrest, who's a young, good-looking guy, gets accused 3 days ago, and we hear nothing about it.
Well, like, you know, once again, Ryan Seacrest is just some vapid Hollywood actor who doesn't really, I mean, maybe he might not get a movie role, but, you know, who's going to fire Ryan Seacrest? He doesn't really have a permanent employer. He's an actor who's kind of a freelancer, isn't he?
Yes.
Ryan Seacrest has, like, five jobs. He has E! News. He's on The Kelly Show. I mean, he's got more jobs and more notoriety than Charlie Rose ever has. I don't know.
You're just out of touch, Di.
I guess I am. Well, you know, I don't listen to music created after 1980, so.
Just Google Ryan Seacrest. He's got like five jobs.
I mean, appreciate it, Tony. We need to take a quick break.
I have to renew my subscription
to
People Magazine.
Jim, you want to do the break for me?
No, huh? Go ahead.
Okay. It's 9:49, a quick break, coming right back. We're talking during that break about early primaries, et cetera. It's interesting to me to see what direction these billionaires are going with their advertising. Pritzker seems to be running against Trump. I don't, you know, does he realize who the governor is?
Well, who's Ronner running against? He's running against Madigan.
Yes.
Everybody's looking for the bad guy to run against, not each other.
Yeah, but at least the Madigan's in the state.
Well, as I was mentioning over the break, the filing period starting next Monday for March primary is an ongoing disgrace to both political parties, and it's a sign about how the bosses in both political parties are equally culpable by having this system in place, which is designed solely to make it harder for any non-incumbents to run and to leave the control of the power structure with the leaders of both parties. And you can look around the nation. Some states don't have primaries until September before the November election. We could easily do it in June or July. It should be done then in non-presidential years, which is 2018.
Well, how has that changed? How do you get to
change? The legislature. And in fact, there have been bills introduced in the legislature, and the Tsar of Madagascar doesn't like this idea, but I don't blame Mike Madigan, because this is a joint enterprise. Thompson, Edgar, Ryan, all the Republican leadership, they think this is just fine too, and it's a disgrace to both of them. The only losers are the people of the state of Illinois, and as we know, the politicians don't care anything about them.
And the way you hide it, Jim, is you say, we want to be so we're considered for the presidential election, that our choice for the nomination is early, but it's really about everybody else.
Yeah, and that's a presidential year. That would be it's a colorable argument, as they say, in 2016, 2020. There is no colorable argument in 2018 and why we have this early primary, other than to make it advantageous for the political leadership and to make it difficult for the people.
We only have a couple of minutes. No, we've got about 5 minutes left before we move on to some other big topic. But
quick
point. You have something to add to that?
Jim Dye made a point about this gerrymandering case and about how things are up before the U.S. Supreme Court. And I'm really concerned that apparently it's Anthony Kennedy, once again, who has the votes in the balance. And one of the interesting things to point out is, isn't it amazing how the conservative justices on the court, supposedly conservatives like Kennedy, sometimes go left, but the leftist justices never go right. For instance, I'm a careful watcher of the U.S. Supreme Court. I do not remember the last time ever that the discussion was on some important case, such as the Obamacare decision that came up several years ago. How's Ginsburg going to vote? Where will Breyer be on this? How will Kagan vote in this matter? Somehow that never seems to be an issue, Mike. It's only how will the Republican appointees judges go? And literally in the last, can you recall? I can't. This is not hyperbole. The last time there was what could be viewed as a political sort of case like Obamacare, where a Democrat appointee to the U.S. Supreme Court did not follow the party line.
No, they've been in the minority for 60 years. That's why the swing vote has always been a Republican, whether it's Kennedy, Sandra Day O'Connor. But if we go back a long time, we have people who've been considered bad appointments. Also, Wizard White was one who usually voted with the Republicans and was a Kennedy appointee. But that's a long time ago. You're dead right. Yeah. And that's why.
So we have David Souter, and we have Sandra Day O'Connor, and we had Brennan, who Eisenhower said was the worst damnful mistake he ever made in his
life.
But
he owed that because he had made a deal with the Republican power brokers in New Jersey to let Brennan get the job, of all things.
Let's put an idiot on the Supreme Court.
I always like to remind people the Supreme Court has had a majority of Republicans appointed for over 50 years.
Let's go to the phones for Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello, Jim. Hello, judges.
Good morning.
Listen, back to your Mike said he was a history teacher.
Yes,
I was.
Yeah, here's what's at hand here is revisionist history and taking history out of context.
You're cutting out on us a little bit there.
I said. Taking history out of context is a major problem right now. You know, events happen, you know, like you said, someone said 300-400 years ago, and you judge them by the standards of today. Well, none of it's ever going to wash. You know, I mean, take slavery. I mean, those people were sold into slavery by their own people. You know, I mean, there was slavery before the slaves came to the United States. It's all biblical times all across the world. Where people of power have indentured or, you know, appropriated other people. There's nothing unique to the American experience or the North American experience regarding that, you know.
Now, history is an ugly thing. It's essentially one conquest after another.
Then you go with the Columbus Day and all the vilification of Columbus, which I find, you know, egregious because, again, that's being taken out of context. A lot of people wouldn't be sitting in their homes right now all across this hemisphere were it not for that for those explorers back in that day. So I don't get it, Judge.
Sounds like you don't celebrate National Indigenous Peoples of Color Genocide Remembrance Day, which is what we sensitive folks of the teens call Columbus Day.
I don't, because I don't know if there are any indigenous people here. They didn't just sprout up out of the ground. They came over the Bering Strait, you know, years and years ago. So that's a weak argument, you know, about it. What is indigenous? That's a flexible term. Anyway, thanks for listening. You have a great day.
Thank you.
Glad you called, Eric. Thanks right. very much. We are indeed out of time during the first hour, but we'll take a quick break here for some news from CBS, some local news to follow that. And then we will come back with hour number two with a reminder that we're at 356-9397. And you can text us as well. Had mostly phone calls this morning, but you can text us if you would care to. That number is 351-5357. So stick with us. We're going to break for the news and come right back here on WDWS in Champaign-Urbana. Welcome back to hour number two of Penny for Your Thoughts. I'm Jim Turpin. My guests are Jim Dye from the News Gazette. He's the opinions editor, Circuit Judge Michael McCuskey, and Appellate Court Justice Robert Steigman. Notice how I read those in a different order now? I didn't want Dye, I didn't want Dye to feel so bad. Because
he handles it well, though.
I'm definitely the third banana here.
Jim and I both want to ask the two judges, what's this about that guy going to sleep?
Oh, God.
Sleeping judge.
I feel sorry for Jeff O'Connor. I've known Jeff for over 30 years. He is an outstanding judge. If Jeff was here, I may say, because I've had the same problem. And sleep apnea is a common thing. And when you're in the courtroom and they turn all the lights off and you have sleep apnea, which mine had not been diagnosed, it is a disease, Mayo's. It's tough with sleep apnea to stay awake. It is.
Now, what a pathetic defense.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you had a disease, this is a disease, Jim. It's not laughable. And this
well,
is,
now, are you saying he has sleep apnea?
Once you're at Mayo's and they say your neck size is 17 or you're overweight of any size, you need to be checked out. And most people ignore. They fall asleep at stoplights. They fall asleep in conversations. They fall asleep when the lights go off. I believe he's got sleep apnea and doesn't know it. He's a very big guy with a very big neck.
Mike's answer is putting me to sleep here.
Yeah, well, I'm just telling you, this is serious. Yeah. This is serious stuff health-wise. I also believe that my heart attack at age 56 when I was a federal judge, I'd like to put it off on Tim Bass, who's gets written about, but I think it was because I had the disease and it was undiagnosed.
What do you think about it? In defense of sleep, how about it?
This is further evidence why Mike McCuskey is a nicer guy than I. This may be the story, but, you know.
But the majority said it wasn't a problem.
You're trying a murder case, Judge, and you got to stay awake.
I'm not defending. I would have voted to reverse. Yeah, I would have been with the dissenter.
Yeah, you have to know your own situation. And I've sometimes this can get really boring stuff.
Oh,
and
I know.
At a minimum, you have to, and I've done this, I've put my head in my hands and I've just listened and tried to pay attention that way. But to actually fall asleep, I think what you have to do, it's kind of like driving, pull over. What you have to do is if you literally can't stay awake, who's in charge? Just say, call a recess. We're getting time to have a recess. And
now, listeners who aren't familiar with this, we had a murder trial in which the judge briefly fell asleep during a video presentation of some evidence. And so the defense said, hey, we got to have a new trial. And they went to the appellate court, and the appellate court ruled 2-1 that it was harmless error. So now we have judges that now have legal authority to sleep in the courtroom.
And the interesting thing, Jim, about the majority. And they used a case where the judge actually decided, look, I got a phone call. It's more important. Let's go take the phone call and leave the courtroom. They did that. The dissenter said, don't you leave the courtroom when you're asleep?
Yeah. So did you think the dissent had the better argument?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I did too.
Did you?
Yes.
I thought it was pretty persuasive. At the same time, I thought, well, it certainly looks bad, but in terms of affecting the outcome of the trial, I don't think it probably
No, but there's certain procedures
you have to follow. You're not the guy on trial.
Yeah,
either.
This might be called structural error.
Yeah, yeah.
The question, and it's a good question, there was an error here, but was it harmless? And
right.
You can ask that question in most instances, and if you think this guy was so guilty, we're going to say the error was harmless and affirm the conviction.
In this case, this was a multiple victim murder trial, and the evidence was overwhelming.
It was, but the structural errors, like when a judge walks out of the courtroom, that's what the case Mike's
right.
talking about,
yeah.
took a phone call and told the lawyers, you guys keep going.
Going.
You know, That can't be right.
I'll tell you another structural error. It could be absolute. You got the video, you got the eyewitnesses, the guy stabbed somebody to death. So the judge says, this could be a dangerous guy. Let's shackle him and bolt his feet down in the courtroom and let the jury see that. That's a struct. You don't do that.
Yeah, that's another example of bad stuff.
Let's see what Bill has to say this morning. Hello, Bill.
Good morning. This may be an old question. some people probably put them to sleep. But I think when you're talking government policy or decisions, I don't think there's a person on the planet that's not political in some way. That includes judges and political commentators, newspaper people, the media, politicians, everyone. My question is, I've heard Alan Dershowitz say that colluding with the Russians, there's no crime on the books, or no statute on the books makes that a crime. And but yet Robert Mueller was appointed special counsel. And I just don't know who to believe. I've heard that there has to be a specific crime that's being investigated before a special counsel can be appointed.
That's a very good question.
I have two quick responses. The first is with regard to everyone's got some political leanings and views and all that. I think that's clearly true. And one of the important things that, for instance, if you're a reporter reporting the news, or if you're a judge who's hearing a case, you're supposed to recognize these leanings, not failings, but your own leanings, and overcome them. It's not that hard to do. You're in this important position if you're a judge, and it shouldn't matter to you because you're not upholding the office if you take into account the political connections of the lawyers or the defendants or how this case will be viewed. People say, well, can you do it? And you can and you should. You're in the wrong job if you don't. I think news reporters, when reporting the news, might be aware of their own biases, but they ought to report it objectively. And the key is so that someone reading the story wouldn't be able to tell what the personal biases are of the guy reporting the news. Now, going back to collusion, it's been over a year now we've been hearing about collusion. And the wonderful thing about that term is how amorphous it is. I've on this program, we've had that discussion. I say, what does that mean? Collusion covers all kinds of potential different things. And what Mueller, if that's how to pronounce his name, is apparently looking into is, are there specific facts that might constitute some criminal involvement from connections that people in the Trump campaign may have had with Russians or other third parties that might constitute a violation of criminal law. The idea about collusion and, bless his heart, I've heard Tucker Carlson press some Democratic congressman on this, say, what do you mean? Will you define this term for me? And I've yet to hear anyone really define it, which doesn't mean to say that there couldn't be some underlying facts here, but I just don't know what they are.
Well, speaking of collusion, you have the Manafort thing. He was under investigation and he's been indicted, but the indictment against him has
nothing to do with the campaign.
Nothing to do with anything. I shouldn't say nothing to do with anything. Nothing to do with the presidential campaign. In fact, it involves alleged wrongdoing that occurred years before that. So you do have, collusion is not a federal crime. You do have to have specific acts of wrongdoing, and I guess that's what Mueller's looking for, and I suppose he's going to indict Mike Flynn, but from what I've read about Flynn, what he's involved with has nothing to do with politics either.
Well, I'll give you an example. With Blagojevich, the conspiracy, so you start out investigating conspiracy, and as a federal judge, you're issuing wiretaps all the time on conspiracy. And the amazing thing that happens more often than not is you're looking to see if somebody is conspiring to commit a certain crime. And what happens? When they investigated the financial affairs of Jesse Jackson Jr. and his wife to see if they were involved in conspiring to buy a Senate seat, they ended up saying, no, they weren't doing that, but they were cheating on their income taxes big time.
Mike, you've been a judge for a long time, too. Wouldn't you say that it's not as hard as a lot of people think to be able to set aside your own individual thoughts, biases, etc., when you're sitting as a judge and just handle the job the way it should be?
It's easy for me because my background. I was an athlete. I was involved in college sports. I was a coach, a baseball coach. And that's where you're an advocate. But you also watch these people officiate all the time, and you understand that their job is try to do their best to be impartial. And fans are always yelling, somebody's been paid by somebody, somebody's got a friend. After you grow up in athletics, I think you understand what the referee's job is and we're the referees. I got into an argument recently with a friend, and I like being involved with people who aren't college educated. And he goes, you judges let people go. In 30 years, I've never had a bench trial where I let anybody go because we rarely get a bench trial. It's the citizens that let people go. They find them not guilty. Judges don't.
Okay, guys, we need to move on here and talk to Pat. Hello, Pat.
Hi, Jim. I'm sorry to hear you're leaving. With this apnea thing we're talking about, sleep apnea, don't you wake up during the night? No, you stop breathing.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, there's such a thing called narcolepsy where you fall asleep, but you don't do like apnea.
Yeah, there is. That's a different disease.
Yep.
And they're both really bad health-wise and things that you can be driving a car and really have an impact on somebody's life.
Joe, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Joe.
Gentlemen, this has been eating at me for quite a while. We've been hearing all these complaints about Russian interference in our election and Russian collusion and Russian this and Russian that. But we have yet to hear anybody bring out anything about the fact that Barack Obama spent $300,000 to $500,000 of American taxpayer money to interfere in the Israeli election to try to get Benjamin Netanyahu unseated.
That was different.
What's your opinion? Why is that different?
Because
I think he's being not serious in his response there. I think Judge Steinman thinks it's exactly the same thing.
Yep.
You want to say why?
Well, it's something that this country has done for a long time. The case of Barack Obama and the re-election of Netanyahu, it was pretty blatant and upfront about it. And I think it's possibly because they thought it might actually be helpful to the opposition to Netanyahu and Israel if it was that blatant. But it's not just there. But this is what countries have done throughout, people putting their thumb on a scale. We had, how about what did the European leadership say in October of 2016 about the American presidential election? Angela Merkel, as I recall, was pretty clear about how she didn't think much of Donald Trump. Was that collusion with the Democrats? Was that something to put the thumb on the scale? It's in my judgment, a lot to do about nothing. This is just like even our friends spy on us and we spy on them. Angela Merkel's telephone was tapped and Barack Obama had to apologize for that. This should be greeted with a big shrug. And the notion that this affects the legitimacy of the election because of something the Russians may have done is just silly.
Well, it's nicer today than it used to be. If you watch Ken Burns' series on Vietnam, where they finally have been able to get all kinds of records, we wanted a regime change in Vietnam, and the CIA orchestrated the death. And Kennedy said, well, I didn't want that. I didn't want him dead. So historically, the CIA, we've killed people to have regime change. Now we just try to do it through the political process.
We go to Kathy. Hello, Kathy.
Hello. I was wondering if your guests might comment on how the protesters were handled during the U of I homecoming parade. I'm just wondering if they think that they should have made the move so the parade continue. Should they have been arrested? Just curious how they feel about how it was handled.
Well, I defer to Mike McCuskey on this.
Because I wasn't here.
He's a fellow who's been on the Board of Trustees of the Illinois State University. He's dealt with university administrators a lot better than I. Mike, what would, as a president of the Board of Trustees, had this been a parade in Bloomington Normal and the same thing happened, what do you think the administration there would have done? What would you have liked to see him do, and what would the board say?
If we would have known, first you have to know, and then tell the university police that nobody's going to block the parade, whether it's the president or Tom Kasich with the Cub fans at the end of the parade. People have a right to free assembly, free speech. And unfortunately, we must be getting the wrong students historically at ISU, because we've never had this problem and there was never a window broken back in the war.
Here's the question.
The question is, though, what should the University of Illinois, they stopped the chancellor's...
Did they know? If they knew, they should have stopped it.
Well, police officers were...
They were present.
I wasn't here. Okay.
And the chancellor just directed him, I think, just to let the protesters.
Here's a question I'd like to ask Chancellor Jones, and that is this. Had the same actions been taken to block the parade and block his car by the Honor the Chief folks, would his attitude have been the same?
That's the question.
And I suspect no. Because I suspect that Chancellor Jones and the great majority of the faculty are anti-chief and are, frankly, leftist. That's why we have this problem with free speech in the First Amendment, which means that the reason they're not taking the action they should take is because they are in sympathy politically with these folks.
You know, when they talk about you should arrest them, and they say, well, we don't want to make a big mess out of everything, and it's better just to let it go. I mean, you don't have to turn this into a war. All you have to do is give notices to appear in court on a charge of disorderly conduct, and then that's that.
The only person that was put in a police car was the Chief of Lineawick. they wanted to get him out of there because he was the one that they...
Well, you know, we had the business where, they blocked the parade. And so if you ignore this kind of conduct, you get more. So I think today's paper, we have a story about where, remember, the faculty was charged with assaulting two students because he didn't like their political views, and they got into a dispute on campus. You have to put some restraints on people's behavior, otherwise they will run amok.
I think the former president of the Board of Trustees of ISU had a good description for university administration in this regard as being gutless.
Yeah, that got me some publicity, didn't it? Well, let me go back to being impartial.
Okay.
I did not hear any of the chief cases that came to federal court. Why? Because I was at the Honor the Chief events. My wife and I and son wear chief clothing, still have it. So that really would be the appearance of impropriety for me to hear that case. There are some people actually would do that and wouldn't care. But that's how you try to be impartial when you have a belief that you believe would override fairness. So I sit back and watch this, and I'm going, when will this ever end?
How about the president of the University of Chicago, Jim Nye? What did he say about all this?
Well, the University of Chicago and Purdue and a couple other enlightened places have taken a position that the First Amendment applies to the campus of the University of Chicago, that everybody is allowed to be heard and nobody is allowed to be shouted down by people who don't want them to speak.
And if they are, they will be arrested.
And well, if this is a problem, if this is a problem for you, Snowflake, don't come to this school.
Well, and they did have to put the chancellor in a police car for his own protection.
Yeah, isn't that
awful? That's a disgrace, too.
Yes.
Because we were driving the car that he was on, and they asked, would you like to get in a police car? And he said yes.
Here's the fundamental point that Jim Dye made reference to again, and has to be spoken once more. What we as parents all know is this. The more you tolerate bad behavior, the more you can expect to see it. What's the issue? So if you tolerate bad behavior, if you tolerate people screaming and disrupting and not permitting speakers to be heard, if you tolerate confrontations like this where they're engaging in a criminal act, blocking a lawful parade, then and you're agonizing over what to do about it, you shouldn't be surprised that you get more of it.
Well, thank you, Kathy. We appreciate your call. We're running into the 10:30 news here in just a moment. Any final thoughts on that?
Yeah, I was going to say the perfect example of that is that at the University of Oregon, where they ran the president of the university off the stage. He was about to deliver a State of the University speech. The protesters ran him off the stage, took over the event, shut the whole thing down, and then for some reason, I don't know what happened to the university administration, they decided that some of these kids should be subject to discipline, and the outrage among those being targeted by discipline for the fact that they're being targeted for discipline has been extreme.
I mean, and the faculty.
And
the faculty.
They can't believe that they're being held accountable for this, and they think it's a wrong thing. Well, that's what happens.
I guess I'm glad that I graduated from someplace other than the schools we're talking about, because the governor would have appointed me on the Board of Trustees here instead of at ISU, and I would have been a problem, because I agree with everything you say. And in 10 years on the Board of Trustees, 7 as chairman of the board, I never had any of them.
What was that word you used? It starts with a G?
Gutless.
Gutless, yeah. I thought that was
I think it's fair to point out that we are talking about a minority of a minority of a minority of the students on campus.
But if you allow them, as Bob said.
I'm just saying that they're not all doing
that. That's the one we're reading about, though. That's the one that's in the headlines.
And I think, unfortunately and regrettably, a majority of the faculty who is in sympathy with this.
That could be.
We need to stop now at 10:30 for the news headlines with Brian Barnhart. Back with our final half hour with our panel after that. Here's Brian. Welcome back to our final half hour with the panel. We're at 356-9397. Our text line is 351-5357. And we go to Eric. Hello, Eric.
Good morning, gentlemen. I apologize in advance. I had kind of asked this question when Jedi was on once before, so I wanted to kind of direct it at the judges. Regarding the Christensen case that's going on in Champaign right now, I just wondered your gentleman's take on the fact of when the federal government appears to have this case down cold as far as all the facts and all that are pretty hard to dispute, what advantage is it for Mr. Christensen to draw this all the way out, take it to trial, go to the end of it, instead of, you know, working with him or working on a deal as far as trying to resolve sooner rather than later, dragging it out?
Well, you have to remember first that the Constitution allows the defendant the right first to choose whether he wants a jury trial. And if he wants a jury trial, that's the constitutional right of the defendant, not his attorney. So if the attorney says, oh, we'd like to work out a deal, we'd like to have you cooperate, we'd like to have you do this, if the defendant says, I want my jury trial, he will get the jury trial.
The other thing is, to the credit of the federal government in this case and the defense attorneys, this case is not being tried in the press or even being talked about in the press, and it shouldn't be. I know we're all curious about it. But contrast that with the sieve in Washington, D.C., where, by the way, all these leaks about what's going on with Robert Mueller are violations of the law. And somehow CNN and the other news broadcasters don't seem to be bothered by it or mention that. But that's not what should be going on. The reason I mention that is we do not know, and we have no right to know at this point, what sort of discussions might be taking place between the defense and the prosecution. So we can speculate about it, but to say that it's not happening is certainly something that we have no basis to say.
Mike, if they decide to go for the death penalty here, then it appears that this trial will be set back.
Automatically.
Automatically.
Automatically. I had, I think, 3 times in 16 years of prosecution, the U.S. Attorney's Office asked for the death penalty. The first thing you do as a district judge is appoint an attorney on the issue of the death penalty. I appointed Steve Beckett. Steve would be great if you get him on the next month, asking him about the process. You go to Washington, D.C. The attorney general appoints, because the attorney general is the chief prosecutor on these matters, a 3-lawyer from the Justice Department panel to hear evidence and argument as to why there should be a death penalty. They make a recommendation to the Attorney General, and in every one of my cases, whether it was a Republican or Democrat Attorney General, the Attorney General said, this isn't a death penalty case. That's it. That's the end of it. And then it comes back. So that's where the delay is. I've seen it at 6 months to a year before the Attorney General makes a decision after the hearings, after the arguments, after the recommendations. So it is a separate procedure in Washington, D.C.
It's too long, Jim. Mike has described it correctly, but there is no reason, and it's one of the great embarrassments. I've been now involved in judiciary for going to be starting my 42nd year, and one of the really great embarrassments has been how long death penalty litigation has taken, that people have been on death row for 10 years or 15 years. It's outrageous. And a big part of the reason is judges, and this goes back to the question the caller made, judges who don't like the death penalty are unwilling to apply the law. They're looking for ways to avoid it, and it's not their proper role to do it. And the result is the embarrassment of having this going on decades for someone who's finally coming up for execution, and it looks to the public like this is ridiculous, and they're right.
Well, the other side of it is, the ridiculousness is when DNA comes in and then people are exonerated because of the delay, that they were not there, they did not commit the crime. They might have looked like somebody on an eyewitness, but they weren't there. DNA says, you get out of jail now, you were innocent.
That's true. That sounds like a good reason for the legislature to abolish the death penalty like it did in Illinois, instead of having the judges just not enforce the law.
Well, one quick point on this. Since I was involved in death penalty litigation, the last one was Harry Gosher, who received the death penalty. I imposed it after the jury found him guilty and said he should receive the death penalty. That was 1988. And regarding the people who say, well, there's all this uncertainty about the death penalty, Harry Gosher pleaded guilty. And we had the eyewitness to his committing these crimes. So the notion that, well, we can't be sure, may have some merit in some cases, but hardly in all, and that's one I'm personally familiar with, which
correct.
Was an outrage. Yep. And that was where George Ryan, our soon-to-be felon governor, decided that maybe I'm going to pardon all of these people, commute all of their sentences, rather, and that was... It was outrageous.
He was also lived within a block or two of the Small family. I was involved in the appeal on the girlfriend who didn't get the death penalty. Death penalty goes to Supreme Court. And so the person who was on death row for killing a personal friend down the street from George Ryan was let go when George Ryan pardoned everybody. So he was... Somebody who pardoned people he didn't know and pardoned people.
Yeah, that was the small kidnapping
right.
case.
Yeah, Harry Gosher
had
been...
buried the guy alive.
Yeah. Gosher had been 13 years on death row, having pleaded guilty when this commutation occurred from George Ryan. And the question is, why was that? The case had been through the Illinois Supreme Court multiple times, and including through, I like to say, an idiot federal judge who granted a habeas corpus hearing, only to have the Seventh Circuit say there was no basis to it. I wound up testifying at that hearing because, you spent an hour and a half taking guilty plea, but was it appropriate, Judge? And I looked at him like, what are you talking about? And the Seventh Circuit said there was no basis to even do this. But still, we got 13 years going here, and it was a prime example that I was personally familiar with of a failure of the system to properly handle these cases.
10:44, we need to take a quick break. Back to the phones right after that.
I forget the name. It was the Latino federal judge.
David Corr.
We're back on Penny for Your Thoughts. I'm Jim Turpin. We're visiting this morning with a panel, Robert Steigman, Michael McCuskey, and Jim Dye. And we go to Annawald. Hello, Annawald.
Good morning. I'm really enjoying the program, and I hate to interrupt it, but I had a young lady who came to me with a question that I could not answer, and that's why I'm calling to take advantage of your intelligentsia. This young woman is upset because she has a daughter who's going to Franklin Junior High School. And this woman wants her daughter to be motivated to get high grades. And she told me that they were not being motivated to get higher grades, but just by attending class, they could pass. Now, I just want to know what the your people think about this. How can she, I mean, what is the articulation between the legislature or the lawyers in the schools? What can the parents do about it?
Well, we think policy comes from the top down, from the principal.
Well, let me jump in because, Jim, did your daughter go to Franklin?
No.
My son graduated from Franklin. Maybe things have changed. When my son, he went to Barkstall, then he went to Franklin. And we thought that the teachers were pushing him just exactly the way they should to make him ultimately college bound. We were very happy with Franklin. If these things have changed, that's unfortunate. But it wasn't that long ago my son was at Franklin. We were very happy with how he was taught.
Good.
Yeah, it's one of those things, right? I think that's going to have to come from the parent and try to explain to a kid that, you know, this is, education is important. And but I don't envy anybody the task of having to try to persuade an 8th grade or 9th grade kid of anything. They don't necessarily see the point to it, and all their friends don't see the point to it. I think that's going to be hard. But, you know, you maybe have to establish some system of carrots and sticks. You know, you do well, you get to do these things. If you don't do well, then maybe some sanctions apply.
You know, the same thing's true in college. It wasn't that long ago that the teachers were not allowed at Stanford to give anything but a ABC. Because a DF meant that we picked the wrong students. So everybody in California knew that if you came out of Stanford with a 2.0, you were passed through for non-discipline problems and attendance.
Well, great inflation. That's a whole other scandal, isn't it?
Let's go to Don. Good morning, Don.
Hey, how you gentlemen doing?
Good.
Morning. What's up? The judge was saying that the leaks and stuff were illegal. And I just have to say at this point, I'm kind of finding it very hard that any of it is actually illegal enough to the point of prosecution because nobody gets prosecuted for it. For example, Comey, you know, said he leaked it so they could get the council started in the first place. You know, he said that under oath even. And he's still not in jail, not even, I don't think, been charged with anything for it. And you have the lady at the DNC to prove that that was rigged. Nobody's going to jail for any of these crimes. They can prove that Hillary, you know, they smashed the phones and hard drives and all that. Ain't nobody going to jail for any of those offenses. So I just, you know, at this time, I would, you know, kind of disagree that it's actually that illegal.
Well, to say something is illegal is different from talking about how there's an active investigation seeking to prosecute it. With regard to the latter, there has to be the will to do it.
Let me give you the biggest illegal, and I do believe it was illegal, and leak, and it happened right here in Champaign. Balco is on the federal radar. So was Marion Jones. So was Armstrong.
Tell them which case
I'm going to give it to them. So all these people are in an indictment, proposed indictment. They're coming to me to give a search warrant for the chemist in Champaign-Urbana who was making the chemical formula for all of these sports enhancements. So I'm reading this. Lots of it are deleted because it's irrelevant to my search of is there probable cause. And when I'm done, I said to one of the federal agents from San Francisco, this thing is so big. If somebody leaked it, I would love to be involved in prosecuting and putting that person in jail because this is serious, serious stuff. Let me finish. This is a good story. Okay. Everybody should hear.
Go ahead.
I signed the search warrant. I had a meeting in Chicago. Before I even get out of town, the San Francisco Chronicle publishes that the federal judge in Champaign has issued the search warrant. They had to write the article before the government handed it to me. They can leak when it's the government. I confronted the prosecutor, Tim Bass. He said the defense leaked it. The defense, there hadn't even been a charge filed.
Anything else, Don?
No, I mean, that's what I say. I mean, there needs to be more of you out there because, I mean, we got this guy under oath on TV in front of the American people.
All right, appreciate the call. We need to take our final break. Coming right back. Well, we only have a three or four minutes left. Why don't you guys go ahead with that argument? What was that about?
Well, in the situation I had, Bob wondered why I didn't appoint a special prosecutor, and I said, one, Bass is not involved in the prosecution. They're just presenting a search warrant. Two, the guy from the government in California wasn't a U.S. attorney. And three, it's a California problem. And unless I wanted to be some activist judge creating something out of whole cloth, I had no authority to do anything. It was up to the government to decide whether there had been misconduct by leaking. And the government said, no, the defense lawyer did it. End of story for me.
I don't know federal law. Certainly, I have no way to dispute what Mike says. I'm just going back to my experience as a trial judge in the state. And that is, if the state's attorney's office is engaged in improper conduct, which might be illegal conduct, such as the leaking, which I said is illegal, I think the trial judges in Illinois have the authority to appoint a special prosecutor. You can't look to the local prosecutor's office that might be the have committed the crime to investigate itself, to appoint someone to say, okay, let's get you in front of the grand jury and get you under oath and find out who revealed this information and when and how. And I think one of the problems we have, and one of the problems that we have in Washington, D.C., is a lack of accountability. The press welcomes these leaks, which are illegal. They don't even mention that they're all legal. And
just good reporting. What are you talking about?
Yeah. And until such time as the people who are involved in the leaks are held accountable, or maybe even the pucker moment of being dragged in front of the grand jury to explain what you did and how you did it, I think we're silly to expect that this behavior will change.
All right, John, we only have about a minute and a half, but go ahead quickly.
Okay. Change a little bit. I'm just wondering why in Chicago it takes 5 years to try somebody for a murder.
It shouldn't.
You know,
it's a problem of trial.
5 years.
It's a problem of trial judges who are letting the parties, because the defense has to be complicit in this, letting the parties ask for continuances and not pushing them down. I was a trial judge in Cook County. In 1980, I was there subbing for a guy. Case came up on my call. It was an armed robbery case that had been pending for 6 years. They wanted a continuance. I said, no, we're trying it Wednesday. Guess what happened? They pled out.
It's been 5 years since my daughter was killed, December 18th. And
it's awful.
We still haven't gone to trial.
It's awful. No excuse for it.
I agree.
Yeah. Thank you, John. I appreciate your call, and we sympathize with you. That's a terrible thing to have happen. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
And, Mike, thanks for coming down.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Apparently, this will be my last event with you, Jim. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you allow me to be on your show.
And Robert Steigman, thank you for being here.
Always
Jim Dye, same.
You're certainly welcome.
Great day. Nice trip you made in here this morning. He was on time.
I'm
going
to have to go take a nap after that long walk. I'd be like that judge and he was sleeping in the courtroom.
We are joining the CBS News in Progress. I'll see you tomorrow morning with a 2-hour open line at 9 o'clock here on Penny.